Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Decoupling from China to the extent that we can and the pace at which we can on the economic front has become a major issue. This is our nightmare scenario where Russia and China come together and together they're in a conflict with the West.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast, brought to you by the ANU National Security College with support from policyforum.net. In this episode, Dr. C. Raja Mohan, a long-standing and highly respected analyst on India's strategic direction, joins Professor Rory Medcalf in conversation. His visit to Australia has been made possible by the Asia Society Australia. Before we get into it, we'd like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, traditional owners of the land from which we broadcast. We pay our respects to the elders past and present.
Welcome to this special episode of the National Security Podcast, where we welcome a truly distinguished visitor to the studio from India, an old friend of Australia and a friend personally, Dr. C. Raja Mohan, currently senior fellow with the Asia Society Policy Institute in Delhi, but of course a long-standing and highly respected analyst on India's strategic direction. Welcome to the National Security Podcast.
Thank you, Professor Medcalf. Wonderful seeing you again.
I've known you a long time and we've worked on, I guess, similar issues over the years. We've worked on issues related to strategy, the Indo-Pacific, the global order, the future of Australia-India relations. It's been such an evolving landscape. And I recall meeting you, I think, for the first time 22 years ago, around about this time, October 2000, in a very different set of circumstances, not so long after the Indian nuclear tests and, in my view, Australia's overreaction to those. So you've been a very close watcher and advocate of relations between India and Australia over many years, and that's a story that I think sits within that larger strategic change that India's undergone. How do you read, first, the Australia-India evolution, that really extraordinary story between our two democracies?
It's truly remarkable that how things have changed between India and Australia. As you said, you were there, you know, when we were going through a very bad patch in 2020, post-1998, when India conducted its nuclear tests. And we've come a long, long way. I mean, I would even say, besides the US, Australia is perhaps one relationship that has really truly transformed in India's engagement with the world. It's really all-encompassing partnership today. Today, for example, when I was flying into Sydney the other, yesterday from India, from Delhi, there were two flights almost at the same time. One Air India flight coming into Melbourne and one Air India flight coming into Sydney, both were direct flights. It really tells you the level of engagement today that there are, you know, far greater connects today, I mean, between the two of us in terms of just the number of people traveling. And part of that is related to the growth of the Indian diaspora, which is really, I mean, close to 800,000, I believe, in Australia today, which has become a living bridge between the two sides. I mean, even more important, I would say, is the previous limitation. I mean, we just talked about curry and cricket. But today, I think we have a free trade agreement, limited as it is, but the fact that we have a serious commercial relationship, we have a defense and security partnership that today between India and Australia. We're also part of the Quad along with Japan and the United States. So we're doing things today which were seen as impossible 20 years ago because we really agreed on nothing during the Cold War. there were attempts by different Australian leaders to really connect with India. But each time, the Cold War logic kept separating us. But today, for the first time, I would say our shared interests, we're also colonial cousins, as you know. I mean, there are a lot of things we inherited from the British. Those are in synergy with the contemporary international environment. Therefore, I think today this is really the beginning of, shall we say, a beautiful relationship. My sense is this is just the beginning of a truly expansive partnership that is going to unfold.
So we've spoken a little about the Australia-India relationship and how it's grown so dramatically. It's strengthened in terms of trust and confidence and practical cooperation. And I would agree with you that that goes in many ways hand in hand with the changing strategic environment, with the changing priorities of the international order. I would recall myself that many of the issues that the Indian security community was concerned about in the 1990s and the early 2000s, issues to do with terrorism, issues to do with China, actually now, of course, have come to dominate the global security landscape, so that countries like Australia have, in a sense, followed India in recognizing these problems. But it would be useful to position this in understanding where is India going? Where is India itself coming from? We can come back to the Australia-India thing in depth a bit later on. But what do you see as India's trajectory as a strategic actor? Is it towards some kind of leadership in the international system? Is it more limited than that? Is it away from non-alignment? How would you define India's path?
I would say three big changes, I mean, to understand where India is coming from. The most important thing I would say is the economic transformation. I mean, through the Cold War, I mean, India was also very inward oriented. Its limited exposure to the global economy, I think prevented India from really playing a leadership role, despite its claimed leadership of the non-aligned movement, the third worldism, etc. But the economic weight, I mean, from the 1950s, we had actually a relative economic decline of India from where it was just after the decolonization. This is because of the kind of policies we pursued. But after 1990, the tentative reforms that began in the 90s, the results of which, I think successive governments have reformed the economy in different ways. But today, it's been impossible to imagine in 1990 that India is already well on its way to become the third largest economy. If you look at, purely I'm talking about absolute numbers. Today, we are just overtaking Britain in the nominal GDP, aggregate GDP. It's a matter of time before India overcomes Germany and eventually Japan. So by the end of this decade, I would say India would be the third largest economy, a distant third to US and China, but nevertheless the third. So I think that is a huge transformation, the nature of India. Second, I think what has changed is also India's understanding of the world. I mean, I think through the era of non-alignment and Cold War, steadily we got into a very defensive mode, a mode in which India was kind of fending off threats from the rest of the world, rest of the region. So it was one of, shall we say, in a cricket metaphor, playing defense on a sticky wicket. That was the attitude. But today, India is playing on the front foot. There's much greater sense of self-confidence and a sense that, look, India can do things. It can take leadership. While leadership was a glint in the eye in the 50s for Nehru, today, I think the growth in India's absolute size and its growing partnerships with the US, with the US allies, with a range of other countries, gives India a lot more room to really exercise leadership. The third aspect of it, I would say, is that India's footprint globally has changed. That there was a time when we used to think of diaspora as a brain drain. But today, the fact that you have 4.5 million Indians in US leading the tech industry, if you see, it's really most of the Indians professionals, where do they go? They go to US, UK, Australia, Canada, and New Zealand. So in a sense, the relationship with the Anglo-Saxon world, the English-speaking world, where Indians are making big contributions. So I think India is not just a territorial entity, but it has a global dimension today, which I think gives it connections and networks across the world today, which I think have provided a basis for India to imagine what used to be a prickly relationship with the English-speaking world. Today, I think, is beginning to transform into a collaborative relationship. And finally, I would say within the neighborhood, while the British Empire, the Raj, was deeply connected under the colonial rule, India's socialist enterprise, we cut ourselves off from our own neighborhoods, whether it was the Gulf, whether it was Southeast Asia, whether it was Africa. While there was political solidarity, there was very little economic solidarity. But today, I think the outreach to the Gulf has really changed. India is one of the big customers for Gulf oil. Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have become major partners for India. Similarly, we look at Southeast Asia, we look at Central Asia. So I think India's engagement with the sub-regions of what we call the Indo-Pacific now has significantly grown. So I think all in all, I would say this really, I think for India, this is really the beginning of a new phase where economically strong, a more self-assured elite, and the new immense possibilities globally.
How would you define the interests and the principles that animate Indian policy in this new world? I mean, you've given a sense of the scale of Indian ambition, the growth, not always spectacular, but sustained, of Indian wealth and power. But what are the interests and principles that you think will then drive the policy behavior in the world that will follow?
See, in the past, we used to define, you know, India's identity in terms of non-alignment, and more recently in terms of strategic autonomy. But I always argued that both these concepts are really, in a way, confuse the issue. So all large countries, I mean, seek autonomy. So it's not some unique Indian attribute. Even small countries seek autonomy, even within alliances, within their capabilities and circumstances. I think what has changed in India is that the non-alignment and strategic autonomy arguments that were used to prevent engagement with the West, that today India is no longer defensive, it's not going to let the ideological argument about non-alignment, not to do things with the US or with the or US allies in Asia. Today, I think the understanding that, look, India as a large country will have an independent foreign policy. See, India is never going to be a treaty ally of the United States. It's not going to be like a Britain to the United States or Australia or Japan to the United States. The relationship is one that, as a large country, that's going to build a relationship on the basis of a negotiated terms of engagement. And I think, fortunately, I would say for India, the U.S. understands that today. So the U.S. is saying, look, we're not just looking for more allies. We're looking for capable partners who can work with the U.S. on the basis of shared interests and principles. And that's where I think today, India and the U.S., in spite of the skeptics, both in the U.S. who want to see a greater alliance, and in India, those who worried about getting too close to the U.S., we've made such major progress. And I think central principle is there are shared interests, and India is willing to pursue those shared interests, whether it is balancing in Asia, whether it is constructing a more rules-based order in the international system. Today, I think there is a much greater convergence. So I would say an India that is close to the West, but not, you know, an ally, but is going to work with the West to reshape the international system. So I can to say in the Cold War, we were non-aligned but tilted to the Soviet Union. Today, I would say we are an independent foreign policy that is closely engaged with the West.
And I think there's a subtlety in the way you engage with this that's very welcome. There's often been a simplistic view that either India is fully in a non-aligned camp, or that is as India becomes closer to the United States, that somehow there'll be a fantasy of India being a fully fledged member of the so-called West. And the West is actually a term that that I don't use. I think from an Australian perspective, it's not always the most helpful way to articulate our alignments in the international system. But even so, your point is that there's a convergence of interests, that it will be on terms that India independently negotiates, and that this is a very substantial departure from the India of what the pre-1990s, second half of the 20th century. Is that that's a reasonable way of summing it up?
Exactly. Yeah. And I think partly that the because of the economic change today, I think there's a much greater sense of self-confidence, much greater sense that we can engage the world on reasonable terms, that it is not about keeping the world away from India, but this is about actually India going out and working with the world. Because today, given our economic interdependence, I think with a $3.5 trillion economy, the trade is more than $1 trillion if you put goods and services. So we are connected to the world in multiple ways. So therefore, shaping the world is the big change that is unfolding. I mean, again, to go to the cricket metaphor, I mean, you could be like a Rahul Dravid playing defense, or you could be Sehwag, someone who's going to, you know, play on the front foot, reach out to the world. So I think that is the big shift that is taking place, and you correctly characterize it.
And I'm hoping that at least many of our Australian and Indian listeners are going to understand those analogies to cricket and the long game of strategy that India is playing in the world. I will come back to you a little later on to perhaps challenge you on a few of those points related to a rules-based order, because, of course, many friends of India are watching this year the way the Indian government has responded to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But let me come back to that. I want to stay on that question now of India's new strategic direction and begin looking at some of the other relationships that matter in this space. And of course, we're recording this conversation in mid-October 2022. We've just seen the spectacle over the weekend of the effectively coronation, I would say, of the Emperor of China, if I can put it crudely. The India-China relationship is front and center, I would argue, of the challenges that India faces in its strategic environment. How do you read the development of that relationship? How is India managing that contest?
No, I would say, you know, China is going to be India's principal challenge. It's not just a challenge that we can meet overnight or the coming decade, but I think it's going to be a generational challenge. Because what has changed is still about the 80s, you could see India and China were roughly at the same level, aggregate GDP as well as per capita incomes. So I think the three decades of China's growth in partnership with the West, with the US in particular, I mean, I think has dramatically transformed Chinese capabilities. And Chinese economy, Chinese GDP today is almost five times larger than India's. And Chinese defense spending is four times larger than India's. So the gap between China and India has emerged in a big way. So, and I think dealing with this gap is become the main challenge for India, because you know, in the past we believed that somehow India could befriend China, you know, going back to the 1950s, and even after the 62 war we thought, look, India and China as Asian countries must exercise solidarity with each other, and that befriending China is a fundamental obligation of an Asianist foreign policy of India. But I think thanks to Emperor Xi in the last 3 years, the series of military crises on the border, including the one on 2020, have shook India out of complacence, the belief that that China can be a long-term partner. That China is, you know, undid 30 years of agreements to keep the boundary peaceful and tranquil. And it kind of shatters the confidence of India completely in China. So it's not just a question of what is the nature of the dispute, that itself is large. But the fact that it was completely willing to disregard, you know, formally negotiated signed agreements, so I think has woken up India to the reality of Chinese power and the Chinese claim that they're simply taking what belongs to them and that they have a right to unilaterally change borders. Until now, we saw that happen in South China Sea, vis-a-vis Taiwan, vis-a-vis Hong Kong. But today, in the case of India too, it is trying to do the same. So therefore, this, I think, has woken up the Indian elite, Indian security establishment. So there are two ways in which India is going to deal with it. One, what political scientists call internal balancing, that India needs to grow, India needs to strengthen itself internally. And second is to partner with the US, Japan and Australia and other and Europe in order to do these so-called external balancing. So I think both have become a main lines of foreign policy. Here, I think India, of course, it's not everyone agrees with this in Asia. India's decision to walk out of the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, while Australia and Japan are still part of it, India came to the conclusion that, look, by being part of a Chinese economic sphere of influence, actually, India's is going to further lose its manufacturing capability. Therefore, it must fundamentally withdraw from that and try to reshore manufacturing within India, rebuild its manufacturing capacity. And many have criticized this as protectionism, walking away from free trade. But my sense is this is not the self-reliance of the 1970s, where India kept out foreign capital, constrained domestic capital. But today India sees, without manufacturing, a large country like India cannot simply make progress. While Japan is superior to China and technologically, and it could build a trade relationship. And Australia had its own complementarities with China. But for India, the contradictions have become really sharp on the economic front as well. And the trade deficit is continuing to balloon. So therefore, decoupling from China to the extent that we can and the pace at which we can on the economic front has become a major issue. And then on the military front, we have posted 50,000 troops at 14,000 feet in the Himalayas. They've gone through two winters. So I think it's a reality. You know, it's unlike many ask, what is India doing? But we are the only ones who are actually face to face with the Chinese troops on a daily basis, dealing with their potential for aggression. So I think that's where we are. My sense is on the economic front, on the security front, the challenges from China are real. And third, China has also been the principal block to India's aspirations globally. China is the only country that does not support India's claim for a permanent membership of the Security Council. China has blocked India's entry into the nuclear supplies group. China constantly tries to undermine India's position within the region. So the imagination of the 1950s under Nehru and the imagination of the 1990s was India, China can work together on the multilateral front, despite the differences on the bilateral front. But today, we are as far apart on the multilateral front as we are on the other bilateral issues. So I would say India's contradiction with China is substantive, serious, and I think dealing with it is going to drive many of India's policies.
And I assume that influences, for example, the many strategic partnerships that India's been building, whether it's with the United States, whether it's with Japan, whether it's with Australia, whether it's the Quad or France or a whole range of others. I mean, how does the China factor play into those relationships?
No, I think it is central to all these relationships. The fact that India revived the Quad in 2017 was a consequence of the military crisis in 2017 on our border. Then we had the 2020 crisis, and we've seen this rapidly building up. Americans were interested actually in the Quad, but India was hesitant till 2017, and since then we've seen the fundamental change in India's approach. On the economic front, because of the problems on the China trade front, we are now negotiating trade agreements with Australia, started with the UK and Europe. So there on the trade front too. On the technological side as well, India is now looking to work with the Quad members, with the US, with Australia, to build domestic technological capabilities, be part of the resilient supply chain. So I would say most of the major initiatives are directly linked to the China challenge.
We'll be right back.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
There are several other dimensions in my reading to India's perspective on China. There's the attitude of the Indian people. And of course, that can't be simplified in the way that the Chinese Communist Party likes to talk about the feelings of the Chinese people. India is, you know, extraordinarily mega-sized democracy, if you like. All democracies have their flaws, but India has no short of public opinion. There's also that point you made about almost respect as a civilizational peer. And one thing that's always struck me is that those who want India-China coexistence, or those who even argue that somehow India and China can together dominate a new Asian order, should begin their conversation by asking Beijing to respect India that way. How do you feel about, or how do you perceive, I should say, both of those issues, public opinion in India and the civilizational dimension?
Exactly. And I think, as you said, this idea that, look, we had a shared civilization, and going back to the early part of the 20th century, this great idea of, you know, Asia standing up to the West, Asia's solidarity, Asian unity. These were the big ideals, both the Indian nationalists, Chinese nationalists, even in Japan, in across the region. I mean, people believed in that ideal. And I think that ideal drove India's policy in the 50s. But the 62 war, where we saw the territorial dispute, trumped it. And again, in the 1990s, the fear of the unipolar domination of the United States once again said, look, we need to work together. India and China need to work together. But I think it became clear that, look, China has its own ambitions. Though China today uses the slogan Asia for Asians, it is about really making Asia secure for Chinese dominance. So I think we've been cured, if you will, of the Asianist romance. That today, I mean, I think even our foreign minister, Dr. Jaishankar, has often, you know, recently said, look, that there are cleavages within Asia. None of us, we don't have, between suddenly China and India, do not have a common understanding of where Asia should head, how should territorial disputes be resolved, how should economic relationship be organized. So this notion, many, you know, in Southeast Asia continue to raise as if it is East versus the West. But within the East, there are contradictions. And I think what China has done under Xi Jinping is to sharpen those contradictions by disregarding the sensitivities of its large neighbors. After all, China and Japan and India are the two of the largest neighbors. And with both the countries, China's approach has been one of bullying and attempt to dominate. So the Chinese use the rhetorical device of Asia for Asians, of Asia and the East standing up against the West. But operationally, the challenge for a large number of Asian countries is how do you deal with a unipolar moment in Asia? This, I think India has woken up to this fact. Our problem is not American-dominated unipolar world, but of actually a potentially a China-dominated Asia. And that's the reason why today, working for a multipolar Asia, working, recognizing, in fact, our Minister Jaishankar said, US and Australia resident powers in the Indo-Pacific. And we're going to work with them to produce stability in this part of the world. So I think that's a huge shift from the Asianist ideology to one of actually believing a more universalist conception rather than one of a narrow, self-serving concept of Asian unity that the Chinese today promote.
Look, thank you. That's quite a compelling way to move to the multipolarity of the region and look at some of these other relationships important both to India and to Australia and to put them in their context. I think there is often that that oversimplification, in fact, that gross distortion that Asia equals China and that somehow engagement with this region equals privileging China's interests over those of others, when in fact not only India but others, Japan, Indonesia, Vietnam, we've got this extraordinary diversity in the region. How do you see some kind of manageable multipolar order developing in the Indo-Pacific? And what would you see the roles of India or indeed of Australia in encouraging that?
And I think this simplification of East versus the West, Asia versus the West, I think we're beginning to go beyond that. And the important thing is not producing Asian unity, but of actually creating norms and rules for Asia. And I think one of the central problems of Asia has been territorial disputes. That under Deng Xiaoping, I mean, where Deng said, look, let's keep the disputes aside, let's work together for peace and development, to one where we've seen the transformation under Xi Jinping, to one of saying, look, this is about China reclaiming its territories, China reclaiming glory, and it is simply rest of the countries have to simply adapt to this new reality of China's rise. But I think as a large civilization, I mean, India just simply not going to accept it, will pay the price for standing up to China. My sense is Japan, too, I mean, I think has woken up because Japan has a far deeper historical relationship with China. But today, Japan is building up its defense capabilities. And Australia, too, it's doing that. I think where we have work to do, the Quad members, is really in engaging the rest of the region, which actually, Southeast Asia, for example, benefited greatly from U.S.-China cooperation over the last four decades and has integrated itself deeper into China. But today, as China becomes assertive and U.S.-China differences and China's differences with Japan and India come to the fore, they, I think, are being tempted into a neutralist positions, despite the fact that it is China that is changing territorial status quo, that it is China that is assertive. There is a fear of offending China. There is a fear of standing up to China. So therefore, I think for India, Australia, Japan, and the United States, and we need to offer alternatives, whether it is the Belt and Road Initiative or whether it is security cooperation, that unless we provide those alternatives, the danger of neutralism, in fact, many of my friends in Southeast Asia talk the language of India of the 1950s, which is we are non-aligned. We don't want to take sides between US and China or India and China. But the fact is, it's not a question of neutrality here. It's a question of who is violating the rules. So I think this, given the power gap between US and its many of its Asian neighbors, and given China's growing economic influence, that it is going to be hard for that region. So therefore, I think one of the purposes of Quad would be to reach out to them, to engage with all these countries and say, look, we are here to support your sovereignty. This is not saying that you join our side against China. And I think that's where I would say the Biden administration, I think, has figured this out. So there is greater emphasis on helping China's neighbors to become more sovereign. I think this is a different way of approaching this rather than in the past we used to say with us or against us, all this is about rivalry. This is really about that China's periphery should have the capability and the sovereignty to deal with a strong power. It's only that will encourage China to abide by the rules. And I think that's where we're saying all the right things. Now, the question is we have the hard work of actually convincing our friends in Southeast Asia or in the Pacific Islands, in your case, or in the case of in South Asia, in our case, we need to reassure and offer alternatives to our friends so that there's no neutralization, but they would support a broader framework of a rules-based regional order.
There's a real consonance there in the principles you've identified about offering alternatives, about strengthening the sovereignty of small and middle powers. There's a real consonance, I think, with some of the thinking that the new Australian government is putting into policy now, the new priority being placed on Southeast Asia by our Foreign Minister Penny Wong, the sustained and expanded step up, if you like, in the Pacific. And so I think it's intriguing to think of how Australia and India and others can perhaps work together in those in that regard. You and I have done work in the past on, for example, trilateralism, the Australia-India-France relationship with French colleagues, and I think pursuing and generating much of the thinking behind that framework. Australia-India-Indonesia strikes me as a relationship that needs a lot more work. I know that, you know, there are dialogue mechanisms, but that's the kind of relationship where I think the core strength of our countries could really combine. What's your sense about the prospect for Australia and India to work together in some of those arrangements?
Absolutely. I mean, I would say, I mean, we need to do a lot more. France is an Indo-Pacific power. We need to collaborate more with them. And I think, fortunately, we've gone past that crisis in bilateral relations between Australia and France. And today, we've resumed that dialogue. With Indonesia, where it has actually been far harder to come to concrete. So I think that reflects the broader challenge in Southeast Asia as a whole, that we need to go beyond the mere expression of dialogue. And I think we need to really, focus more on, strengthening each one of our bilateral relations with these countries, and then to draw them into supporting principles that help their own cause. This is where I think we see Japan doing something. For example, Japan today talks about enhancing the capacity of its regional partners. I mean, providing them with greater maritime capabilities. So that is one way. And Australia too does a lot of things in the region. It's coming back into South Pacific, helping them to create their own national capabilities. We have given alternatives, whether it was undersea pipeline in some cases, or of redirecting the aid in a way that meets the aspirations of the local people. And in South Asia too, there was a time when India used to keep U.S. and its allies out of the region, wanting to keep. But today we're coordinating with the U.S., with Australia, to stabilize the subcontinent. So I think we need to find more intensive ways of coordination, collaboration in these regions. And within that, engaging, it's not simply dealing with ASEAN as a whole, but to coordinate our policies in such a way that the strengthens the hand of each country within the region to be able to deal with the Chinese power and Chinese capacity to bend their policies.
And it sounds to me that when you speak of Indian engagement across the broader region, you don't subscribe to the view that somehow there can be very neat lines drawn where China dominates East Asia and India dominates South Asia, and they keep out of each other's way. I mean, what's your view of that kind of theory?
No, I don't think forget India. I mean, Chinese don't buy that. I mean, they see themselves today as equal to the U.S. I mean, they're in Latin America. I mean, they're overfishing in Galapagos Islands in South America.
And all over the Indian Ocean.
Yeah, and they're in the South Pacific. They're everywhere. So I don't think they're looking for a deal with Asian countries. They're benchmarked against the U.S. They say, look, they would like to nudge the U.S. out of Asia and tell the U.S., look, we're open for an accommodation, let's work out principles in which you stay out of our waters. And if you need anything, just give us a phone call.
But you stay out of waters being basically the entirety of Asia and much of the Indo-Pacific as well.
So I think that, it's not – so within that, they think – the rest of Asian neighbors, they're too weak. They think they can manage it on their own, but keep the Americans away. This is where I think finally the U.S. has woken up to this. And today it is trying to strengthen its forward presence. So for India, I mean, the idea that you can cut a separate deal with China, whether in the Himalayas or in a regional framework or in the global, all three illusions have been shattered. On the Himalayas, where the Chinese violation of the territory, the border agreements, within the region where Chinese are looking to expand their own influence, and globally where the Chinese are setting up their own idea of a global, security initiative, global development initiative. So they're not interested in, sharing power with anybody in Asia. So as I say, there's only one tiger on the mountain. And I think that's our problem. And this way, the left groups, whether it's in Australia, in the US, I think labored under the illusion somehow China is more open to accommodation. I think under Xi Jinping, it's become much harder to sustain that argument. I think our left, friends, whether it is Labour in Australia, or Liberals in Europe, or in the US, or in India. Look, China wants to be a great power on its own terms. So this, for this notion that somehow China can be persuaded by being nice to them to accommodate your interests, I think, unfortunately, that is not working. So the need is, we have to produce a balance. That's the only way to get the Chinese to accept some shared rules. Therefore, balance must be the principal objective. I mean, this is not about a permanent confrontation with China or of containment of China, because China is too big. So I think we need to persuade China. They're better off collaborating, cooperating with the rest of the region and with the major powers, rather than exercising unilateral dominance over the region.
And I think balance or equilibrium, or however you want to put it, it's interesting also that this is actually beginning now to transcend political ideology in a lot of our countries. So, for example, a recent guest on this program was one of the most influential Greens members of the European Parliament on China, arguing that, in fact, in many ways, the left in Europe now is recognizing the China challenge, a threat to its political values. And I think a similar journey is happening in this country. We've talked a lot about China, and I can't conclude the conversation without turning back to Russia, the invasion of Ukraine, because you did make the point that the violation of the rules in the Indo-Pacific is one of the fundamental reasons why countries like ours have difficulties with the way China's using its power. Of course, one could say the same on a more grotesque scale at the moment, looking at the invasion of Ukraine when it comes to Russia's behaviour in Europe. There's been plenty of commentary about India's position with regard to this, India's historic relationship with the Soviet Union and then with Russia, India's reliance on Russian weapons and energy and so forth, and frustration from some friends of India about the reluctance India's had to really confront this. How would you define Indian thinking on Russia's behavior in Ukraine, how it's evolving? Where is this going to go?
No, there's no question. I mean, I think the Russian violation of basic principles of sovereignty, which are so dear to all countries, but especially to developing countries like India, where territorial sovereignty is so crucial. I think the problem for India has not been recognizing the problem. It is about finding itself between a rock and a hard place, as the Americans say, is that we don't like what the Russians have done, but we are in a relationship with Russia, which is the weapons relationship. And with nearly 60 to 70% of the inventory, while we buy now a lot more weapons from the US, Israel, and others, the accumulated inventory of the last 60 years of the relationship means that India cannot simply break out of that of that relationship, especially when it is in a war with China, warlike situation with China. So therefore, I think this is where I think India is in a sense trapped of its historic dependence on Russia for weapons, confrontation with China at this point, and the West and China and Russia locked in a conflict. So this is really probably the most unfortunate scenario for India, because ideally for India, a Russia that is at peace with the US and Europe will make it easier to produce a better balance in Asia. But unfortunately, this conflict, I mean, makes things much harder. I would say India, I think, has begun to adjust its position because it knows the longer term effects of this, and that you've seen Prime Minister Modi in the Samarkand summit of the SCO raising questions about the war. And our Minister Jaishankar in the UN talking about the need to, that we got to restore the respect for sovereignty, territorial integrity, etc. But I think the answer to this is really twofold. I mean, I think one, how do we reduce India's dependence on Russia? And there, I would say, India is doing now, unlike in the past, it's emphasizing domestic production of weapons. Here, the Americans, I think, have been very forward-looking. They've said that, look, we want to help India, build its own domestic defense industry. That is a positive side. And my sense is this will take time, but I think at least now there is a beginnings of a process where India can reduce its dependence on Russia. So I tell my friends in India that, look, You keep talking about strategic autonomy. Today, India's strategic autonomy is constrained by Russia. And Russian actions in Europe today constrain India's freedom of action. But how do we overcome this? Here, my sense is the U.S. administration has been shown significant understanding. They're willing to see India's problem and are willing to help India move beyond this. But looking more broadly, I would say, beyond defense, there is very little trade between India and Russia. Oil, of course, we buy. That's really an opportunist market-based thing. India's trade with Bangladesh today is higher than trade with Russia. Annual trade with Russia is around $10 billion. Our trade with the U.S. is $160 billion. Our trade with Europe is around 120. Our trade with China is, again, fairly large, at around $100 billion. So the logic of India's economic relationship is increasingly with the US, with Europe, and with the English-speaking world. And that is, I think, will have a longer-term effect on how this will
work. So there's a journey, if you like, with regard to India redefining its interests in relation to Russia. Is that reasonable?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in the level of people-to-people relationship, there was a time when India, the left parties were very strong. There were deep intellectual ideological connections to Russia. A lot more people traveled up and down. But today, where do Indians travel? I mean, they're traveling to the West. Where do they want to migrate to? They want to go to the English-speaking world. So there's very little people-to-people connect. What you have is the overhang of a government-to-government relationship in a narrow sector of defense. And that's all there is to the relationship. So I would say to all our friends, I mean, look, Russia is about our past. And the lingering effects of that past on our foreign policy, but our future is with the U.S. and its allies and friends in the world, and I think that's where we are headed. But then the path to transition from one framework to another, I think, particularly on the defense side, will take time, and I think at least we're seeing a lot of understanding of this from the government side. In Washington.
So, I mean, without sort of betraying confidences, would you say there is a realization or a sense in the Indian system that in the future, if there's a confrontation with China and India relies on Russia for rapid resupply of weapons and munitions, that's going to be an extraordinary vulnerability? Is there an awareness of that growing in the Indian system?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think if you see the 2020 conflict, I mean, the first thing, we had to go to the Russians to make sure that they would bring in the supplies. But we also saw in that conflict, actually, the U.S. provided a lot of assistance, intelligence sharing, winter clothing, drones. All these really helped us. So my sense is there is a recognition that a growing partnership between Russia and China, which we saw unveiled by President Putin and President Xi, is going to make things worse for us. Because this is our nightmare scenario, where actually Russia and China come together, and together they're in a conflict with the West. So for us, I think ideally Russia should have been at peace with the West. They're not. Ideally, we would like to see Russia play an independent role in this part of the world. That, I think, increasingly will become difficult. Therefore, I think for us, how quickly can we make the transition away from Russia? How do we expand our freedom of action by reducing our dependence on Russia? I think that has become an important strategic imperative today.
Before we finish, I want to ask you two questions that have a nuclear tinge to them, and I think it's appropriate, given that I think when we first met, we were dealing with the aftermath of India's own decision to publicly declare its nuclear capability. Now, I'm not talking nuclear weapons here for a moment. I'm talking nuclear propulsion. I'm talking about submarines. I'm talking about the AUKUS technology sharing arrangement Australia is developing with the United States and the United Kingdom. How is that seen in India?
My sense is India was quite supportive of the AUKUS, though they did not issue many public statements. We had our minister recently say, look, India has no problem with AUKUS. In fact, at the International Atomic Energy Agency, where China was trying to campaign that AUKUS violates the non-proliferation treaty, India worked with its partners to prevent that kind of a resolution going through the IAEA. So for us, I think it is really a stronger Australia that given China's military capabilities, it's going to be increasingly harder to deter China through the old means. That is, the U.S. extended deterrence alone, that is, would help deal with the China challenge. Therefore, you need greater capabilities to its partners. And that's the reason why my sense is the U.S. and Japan are talking about creating new capabilities in Japan. And Japan itself is going to double its defense spending and is looking at ways in which it can create what is called the counter-strike capabilities. You know, 10 years ago, Japan was not interested, nor the U.S. would have supported that. In the case of Australia, I mean, again, equipping Australia to play a larger role in producing what we call now integrated deterrence is as important as building up, rebuilding Japanese. And similarly, the U.S. wants to strengthen India's defense capabilities. And it is also willing to assist a large number of other countries. So therefore, my sense is, in the past, we framed the nuclear issue in very simplistic terms. India has to talk about disarmament. Australia has to talk about non-proliferation. And everything was related to the NPT. But today we realize, look, a legalistic narrow interpretation of the non-proliferation framework does not serve the interests of either U.S., Japan, Australia, or India. For example, the North Korean challenge. The U.S. has liberalized the rules of the MTCR, missile technology rules, to make it easier for South Korea to build capabilities to deal with the North Korean threat. Similarly, I think AUKUS actually is not just about nuclear propulsion. There are going to be other technologies. So the key question is, back to politics, that there is a real threat from China. And this requires a new approach where technologies that were seen as completely protected, the U.S. is sharing it with Australia, and that the need under the integrated deterrence framework, you need capabilities for your friends and partners so that there is a local capability that adds to the deterrence of China. And I think this is the way that has to go, because there is a rise in Chinese power, and the U.S. physical distance from the region demands greater capabilities for its local partners who can develop some what we call in situ deterrent capabilities. So I think this is a good forward-looking step, and that it doesn't then, there's an argument we made together. You can't just rely on the current political fashion in the U.S. Or the goodwill of China to produce peace in this region, that we need local capabilities, which is where I think the U.S. has taken the right step, building its allies and partners' capabilities.
That's a really important point. I think the misperception somehow that Asia collectively is against AUKUS, when you know the what is becoming the most populous nation in Asia and one of the top three powers globally in many senses has a more sophisticated view is quite something else. So thank you for that. Before we conclude, nuclear weapons, nuclear deterrence, and of course one of the shadows and the concerns about Russia's invasion of Ukraine is the role in which nuclear weapons may potentially play as the conflict develops. Can you talk just briefly about what you see as the future of nuclear deterrence globally, and how do we ensure that these weapons are never used?
The Russians, I think, have really complicated the discussion on the nuclear deterrence by raising the threat of the use indirectly. They've said it. I mean, they've said it frequently, but in somewhat oblique terms. But the reality, I think, finally we're beginning to confront that a nuclear armed power, undertaking territorial aggression against a neighbor, and then trying to use nuclear, threat to prevent a restoration of the status quo. So this is something China could do as well in the region. Therefore, I think we need the need for greater nuclear deterrence. Like if Ukraine had nuclear weapons, you could say Russia would have never done what it is doing. That doesn't mean you arm everybody with nuclear weapons. But I think my sense is you need stronger capabilities, conventional capabilities of the countries that are on the borders of Russia and China. You need to better link the U.S. deterrence, nuclear deterrence, to the regional deterrence. While the NATO framework, that's what it does, but you didn't have, Ukraine is not part of NATO, so then how do you reassure The countries on the Russia and China's periphery of deterrent benefits of nuclear deterrence, and then to strengthen conventional deterrence as a way of, you know, that the escalation ladder can be expanded, that it is, we're not jumping from, you know, simple use of artillery to use of nuclear weapons, that the capacity to expand that. And finally, I think I would say it is really, in the end, this is about politics, that the cost to, whether it's Russia or China, in threatening to use nuclear weapons to suit their expansionist aims, there I think the costs, political and economic costs, that's where the sanctions and other instruments come. But combining all this, and this is where I would come back to the notion of integrated deterrence, which is, again, figures in the U.S. national security strategy. They've been talking about a lot. And I think this is where I think those who are seeking to a rules-based order, we must now all work together on the concept of integrated deterrence. And how do we constrain the use of nuclear weapons, especially by those who, revisionist, revanchist powers. I think that is a major intellectual challenge. Because until now, we framed it in narrow technical terms. This is all about, technical nature of the nuclear weapons. But today, the integrated deterrence model, I think, offers us to think about this politically, think about this far more strategically rather than the technical nature of nuclear weapons.
There's so much more we could talk about, but you've been incredibly generous with your time and your insights today. It's always a privilege to share assessments with you. Thanks for joining us on the National Security Podcast. And I would note that your visit to Australia is supported by our friends at Asia Society Australia. Thank you, Dr. C. Rajamohan.
Thank you, Professor Metka, for having me.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.